The Bishop of Rochester lifted his glove. Gawain, cannot we leave this wrangling to another time? The immediate business is to restore the Queen. No doubt Sir Lancelot would like to make an explanation of the trouble so that the Church may be justified in his reconciliation. Thank you, my lord. Gawain glared about him, till the king's tired voice prompted the proceedings. They were going forward clumsily by a series of jerks. You were taken with the queen.
Sir, I was sent for to my lady, your queen, I know not for what cause. But I was not so soon within the chamber door, when immediately Sir Agravaine and Sir Mordred beat upon it, calling me traitor and recreant knight. They called thee right! My lord Sir Gawain, in their quarrel they proved themselves not in the right. I speak for the queen, not for my own worship.
Well, well, Sir Lancelot. The ill-made knight turned to his oldest friend, to the first person he had loved with his poises. He dropped the language of chivalry, falling into the simple tongue.
Can't we be forgiven? Can't we be friends again? We have come back in penitence, Arthur, when we needn't have come at all. Won't you remember the old days, when we fought together and were friends? All this wickedness could be smoothed out by the goodwill of Sir Gawain, if you would give us mercy.
The king gives justice, said the red man. Did ye give mercy to my brothers?
I have given mercy to all of you, Sir Gawain. I dare say I may speak without boasting when I say that many in this room are indebted to me for liberty, if not for life. I have fought for the queen in others' quarrels, so why not in my own? I have fought for you also, Sir Gawain, and saved you from an ignoble death.
Yet now, said Mordred, there are but two of Orkney left.
Gawain flung back his head. The king may do as he will. My mind was made 6 months ago, when I found Sir Gareth in his blood, unarmed.
I would to God he had been armed, for then he might have withstood me. He might have killed me and saved our misery.
A noble speech!
The old fellow cried out passionately and suddenly to anybody who would listen. Why will you believe that I wanted to kill them? I knighted Gareth. I loved him. The moment I heard he was dead, I knew you would never forgive me. I knew it meant the end of hope. It was against my interest to kill Sir Gareth.
Mordred whispered. It was against our heart.
Lancelot tried one last effort of persuasion.
Gawain, forgive me. My own heart bleeds for what I have done. I know how you are hurt because it has hurt me too. Won't you give peace to our country if I make a penance? Don't force me to fight for my life, but let me make a pilgrimage for Gareth's sake. I will start at Sandwich in my shirt and walk barefoot to Carlisle, and I will endow a chantry for him every 10 miles in between.
Gareth's blood, said Mordred, is not to be paid for by chantries, we think, however much it might pleasure the Bishop of Rochester.
The old knight's patience broke.
Hold your tongue!
Gawain was flaming on the instant.
Keep civil, my murdering money, or we will stab you at the king's own feet. It would need more.
Again the nuncio intervened.
Sir Lancelot, please, let some of us keep due temper and decency at any rate.
Gawain, sit down. A penance has been offered for Gareth's blood, by means of which the war may be brought to an end. Give us your answer. With the moment of expectant silence, the sandy-headed giant swam into the higher tone.
Aha, heard Sir Lancelot's speech and his great proffers, but he hath slain my brothers. That I may never forgive, in chief his treachery to Sir Gareth. If it please mine uncle King Arthur to accord with him, then the king will lose my service and that of all the Gael. However we may talk of it, we ken the truth. The man is a revealed traitor to the king and to Marcel. There is nobody alive, Gawain, who has called me a traitor. I have explained about the queen. We have done with that. I make no insinuations about the woman, if it be proper not to do so. I speak of what ert your own judgment is to be. If it is the king's judgment, I shall accept it. The king is agreed with me already, before ye came.
Arthur, speak to the king by his title.
Sir, is this true?
But the old man only bowed his head.
At least let me hear it from the king's mouth.
Mordred said,
Speak, father.
He shook his head like a baited bear. He moved it with the heavy movement of a bear, but would not look from the floor.
Speak!
Lancelot, he was heard to say, you know how the truth stands between us. My table is broken. My knights parted or dead. I never sought a quarrel with you, Lance, nor you with me.
But can't it be ended?
Gawain says, he began faintly.
Gawain! Justice!
Gawain rose to his feet, foxy, burly, and towering.
My king, my lord and my uncle, is it the court's will that I pronounce sentence upon this recreant traitor?
The silence became absolute.
Know then, all ye, that this is the king's word. The queen shall come back to him, with her liberty as it was, and she shall stand in nay peril for nothing that was surmised afore this day. This is the Pope's will. But thou, Sir Lancelot, thou shalt go forth, banished out of this kingdom within 15 days, a revealed recreant, and by God, we shall follow thee after that time to pull down the strongest castle of France about thine ears. Gawain, he asked painfully, don't follow me. I will accept the banishment. I will live in my French castles. But don't follow me, Gawain. Don't keep the war forever. Leave that to thy betters. Such castles are the king's. If you follow me, Gawain, don't challenge me. Don't let Arthur come against me. I can't fight against my friends. Gawain, for God's sake, don't make us fight. Leave talking, man. Deliver the queen, and remove your body quickly from this court.
Lancelot pulled himself together with a sort of final care. He looked from England to his tormentor. He turned slowly to the queen, who had not spoken. He saw her ridiculous olive branch, her clumsiness and silly clothes. With a lifted head, he raised their tragedy to nobleness and gravity. Well, madam, it seems that we must part. He took her by the hand, led her to the middle of the room, translating her into his remembered lady. Something in his grip, in his step, in the fullness of his voice, made her bloom again. It was their last partnership into the rose of England. He lifted her to a crest of conquest which they had forgotten. As stately as a dance, the gargoyle took her to the centre. There, poising her flushing, the archstone of the realm, he made an end. It was the last time that Sir Lancelot, King Arthur, and Queen Guinevere were to be together. My king, and my old friends, a word before I go.
My sentence is to leave this fellowship, which I have served in all my life. It is to depart your country, and to be pursued with war. I stand then, for the last time, as the Queen's champion. I stand to tell you, lady and madam, in the presence of all this court, that if any danger may threaten you in future, then one poor arm will come from France to defend you. And so let all remember.
He kissed her fingers deliberately, turned stiffly, and began to pace in silence down the long length of the room. His future closed about him as he went. 15 days to Dover was the time assigned to any felon who had taken sanctuary. He would have to do it in the felon's way, ungirt, unshod, bareheaded, in his bare shirt as if he were hanged on a gallows. He would have to walk in the middle of the road, clutching the small cross in his hand, which was the symbol of his sanctuary. Probably Gawain or his men would be skulking at his heels, in case for a moment he should lay the talisman aside. But still, whether in shirt or mail, he would be their old commander. He would walk steadily, without haste, looking straight in front of him. As he passed the threshold, the look of endurance was already on him. People felt tawdry in the justice room when the old soldiers had left it, and many eyed the red whip sideways with a secret dread. Chapter 11. Guinevere sat in the Queen's chamber at Carlisle Castle. The huge bed had been remade as a settee. It looked tidy and rectangular under its canopy, so that you were shy of sitting down. There was a fireplace with a little pot warming beside it, a high chair, and the reading desk. Also, there was a book to read, perhaps the Galeotto one which Dante mentions. It had cost the same price as 90 oxen, but as Guinevere had already read it 7 times, it was no longer exciting. A late fall of snow threw the evening light upward into the chamber, shining on the ceiling more than on the floor, so as to alter the usual shadows. They were blue, and in the wrong places. The great lady was sewing, sitting rather formally in the high chair with the book beside her, and one of her waiting women, sitting on the steps of the bed, was sewing too. Guinevere stitched away with the half-blank mind of a needlewoman, the other half of her brain moving idly among her troubles. She wished she was not at Carlisle. It was too near the north, which was Mordred's country, too far away from the securities of civilization. For instance, she would have liked to be at London, in the Tower, perhaps. She would have liked, instead of this dreary expanse of snow, to be looking out from the Tower windows at the fun and bustle of the metropolis, at London Bridge, with the staggering houses all over it, which were constantly tumbling off into the river. She remembered it as a bridge of great personality, what with the houses and the heads of rebels on spikes, and the places where Sir David had fought a full-dress joust with the Lord Wells. The cellars of the houses were in the piers of the bridge, and it had a chapel of its own and a tower to defend it. It was a perfect toy town of a place, with housewives popping their heads out of windows, or letting down buckets into the river on long ropes, or throwing out slops, or hanging the washing, or screaming to their children when the drawbridge was going to be pulled up. For that matter, it would have been nice merely to be in the Tower itself. Here in Carlisle, everything was as still as death. But there, in the Conqueror's Tower, a constant ebb and flow of cockneys would be livening the frost. Even Arthur's menagerie, which he now kept in the Tower, would be giving a comfortable background of noise and smell. The latest addition was a full-sized elephant, presented by the King of France, and specially drawn for the record by the indefatigable news hawk, Matthew Paris. When Guinevere got to the elephant, she put down the sewing and began to rub her fingers. They were numb. They did not thaw so quickly as they used to.
"Have you put the crumbs out for the birds, Agnes?"
"Yes, madam. The robin was perky today. He sang quite a trill against one of the blackbirds who was greedy."
"Poor creatures.
Still, I suppose they will all be singing in a few weeks."
"It seems a long time since everybody went away," said Agnes. "The court is like the birds now. It is so silent and heartless."
"They will come back, no doubt."
"Yes, madam."
The queen took up her needle again and pushed it carefully through.
"They say Sir Lancelot has been brave."
"Sir Lancelot always was a brave gentleman, madam.
In the last letter, it says that Gawain had a duel with him."
"He must have been miserable to fight him," Agnes said emphatically.
"I can't think why the king will go with that there Sir Gawain against his best friend. Anybody can see that it is only out of blind temper. And then to lay waste the land of France, just to spite Sir Lancelot, and to do these terrible killings, and to say such things as them thrushes do. It won't do nobody no good to carry on like that. Why can't they let bygones be bygones, is what I ask."
"I think the king goes with Sir Gawain because he is trying to be just. He thinks that the Orkneys have a right to demand justice for Gareth's death, and I suppose they have. Besides, if the king didn't cling to Sir Gawain, he would have nobody left. He was prouder of the Round Table than of anything, and now it is splitting up and he wants to keep somebody."
"It is a poor way to keep the table together," said Agnes, "by fighting Sir Lancelot."
"Sir Gawain has a right to justice. At least they say he has. And the king's choice is not free either. He is swept along by the people, by men who want conquest in France and have made a claim to it, or who are sick of the long peace he has managed to keep, or who are anxious for military promotion and a killing in return for those who died in the market square. There are the young knights of Mordred's party who believe in nationalism and who have been taught to think that my husband is an old fogey. And there are the relatives of the ones who were in the fight on the stairs. And there is the clan Orkney, with their ancient hatreds on their minds. War is like a fire, Agnes. One man may start it, but it will spread all over. It is not about any one thing in particular."
"Ah, these high and mighty matters, madam, they are beyond us poor women. But come now. What did it say in the letter?"
Guinevere sat for some time, looking at the letter without seeing it, while her mind revolved the problems of her husband. Then she said slowly,
"The king likes Lancelot so much that he is forced to be unfair to him, for fear of being unfair to other people."
"Yes, ma'am."
"It says," said the queen, noticing the letter she was looking at with a start, "it says that Sir Gawain rode in front of the castle every day and called out that Lancelot was a coward and a traitor. Lancelot's knights were angry and went out to him one by one, but he charged them all down and hurt some of them badly. He nearly killed Bor and Lionel until at last Sir Lancelot had to go himself. The people inside the castle made him. He told Sir Gawain that he was driven to it like a beast at bay."
"And what did Sir Gawain say?"
"Sir Gawain said, 'Leave thy babbling and come off, and let us ease our hearts.'"
"And did they?"
"Yes. They had a duel in front of the castle. Everybody promised not to interfere, and they began at 9 o'clock in the morning. You know how Sir Gawain can always fight better in the mornings. That was why they began so early. Mercy on Sir Lancelot, to have him as strong as three,
for I did hear tell that the old ones have the fairy blood in them, through the red hair, you know, madam, and this makes the laird as strong as three people before noon, because the sun fights for him. It must have been terrible, Agnes, but Sir Lancelot was too proud not to give the advantage. I wonder he was not killed. He nearly was. But he covered himself with his shield, and parried slowly all the time and gave ground. It says he received many sad brunts, but he managed to defend himself until midday. Then, of course, when the fairy strength had gone down, he was able to take the offensive, and he ended by giving Gawain a blow on the head which knocked him over. He could not get up.
Alas, Sir Gawain!
Yes, but he could have killed him there and then. But he didn't. No. Sir Lancelot stood back and leaned on his sword. Gawain begged him to kill him. He was more furious than ever, and called out, "Why do you stop? Come on, then. Kill me and finish your butchering. I will not yield. Kill me at once, for I shall only fight you again if you spare my life." He was crying.
"We may depend upon it," said Agnes wisely, "that Sir Lancelot refused to strike a felled knight. We may depend. He was always a kind, good gentleman, though not what you may call a beauty. He was the chief of all." They fell silent, shy of their feelings, and began to stitch. Presently the Queen said, "The light gets bad, Agnes. Do you think we could have the rushes?"
"Certainly, madam. I was thinking the same myself."
She began lighting them at the fire, grumbling about the backward place, and the naked northern savages to have no candles, while Guinevere hummed absently. It was the duet which she used to sing with Lancelot, and when she recognized it, she stopped abruptly.
"There, madam, the days seem to draw out."
"Yes, we shall have the spring soon."
Sitting down and stitching away in the smoky light, Agnes resumed her catechism where it had broken off.
"And what did the king say about the business?"
"He cried when he saw how Gawain was spared. It made him remember things, and he became so wretched that he was ill."
"Would that be what they call a nervous shakedown, madam?"
"Yes, Agnes.
He fell sick for sorrow, and Gawain had concussion, so they were bad together. But the knights are keeping up the siege."
"Well, it isn't a very cheerful letter, is it, madam?"
"No, it isn't.
I remember having a letter once. But there, they say bad news travels the fastest. Everything is letters now. Now that the court is empty and the world's split, and nobody left but the Lord Protector. Ah, and that there Sir Mordred, I never could abide the likes of him. What does he want to go a-speechifying at the people for, and taking off his hat to make them cheer? Why can't he dress more cheerful-like, instead of hanging about in that black, as if he were holy doomsday? He caught it from poor Sir Gawain, I dare say."
"The uniform is supposed to be in mourning for Gareth."
"He never cared for Sir Gareth, that one didn't. I don't believe he cares for anybody."
"He cared for his mother, Agnes."
"Aye, and she had a throat slit for being no better than she should be. They're a queer pack, the lot of them."
"Queen Morgause," said Guinevere thoughtfully, "must have been a strange person. It is common knowledge now that Mordred is made the Lord Protector, so it doesn't matter talking about it. But she must have been a powerful woman to have caught our king when she had four big boys of her own. Why, she caught Sir Lamorack when she was a grandmother. She must have had a terrible effect on her sons, if one of them could have felt so fiercely about her that he killed her. She was nearly 70. I expect she ate Mordred, Agnes, like a spider."
"They did used to talk at one time about the Cornwall sisters being witches. Of course, the worst of them was Morgan le Fay, but that there Morgause ran her close.
It makes one sorry for Mordred. You keep your pity for yourself, my lady, for you will get none from him. He has been polite since he was left in charge. Aye, that he has. It is the quiet ones that do the mischief.
Guinevere considered this, holding her material to the light. She asked with some anxiety,
"You don't think that Sir Mordred means to do wrong, do you, Agnes?"
"He is a dark one."
"He wouldn't do anything wrong when the king has left him to look after the country and to look after us."
"That king of yours, madam, if you will excuse the liberty, is quite beyond my comprehension. First he goes to fight with his best friend because Sir Gawain tells him to, and then he leaves his bitterest enemy to be the Lord Protector. Why does he choose to act so blind?"
"Mordred has never broken the laws.
That is because he is too cunning.
The king said that Mordred would have to be the heir to the throne, and you could not take the king and the heir out of the country at the same time, so naturally he had to be left as the protector. It was only fair."
"That fairness, madam, it'll never come to no good."
They sewed away. Agnes added,
"The king should have stayed, if that is true, and let Sir Mordred go."
"I wish he had." Later she explained, "I think the king wants to be with Sir Gawain in case he can moderate between them."
They stitched uneasily, the needles fusing through the dark material with a long gleam like falling stars.
"Are you frightened of Sir Mordred, Agnes?"
"Yes, madam, that I am."
"So am I. He walks about so softly lately and looks at people in a queer way. And then there are all these speeches about Gaels and Saxons and Jews and all the shouting and hysterics. I heard him laughing last week by himself. It was horrible."
"He is a sly one. Maybe he's listening now."
"Agnes!"
Guinevere dropped her needle as if she had been struck.
"Oh, come now, madam. You must not take on. I was only having my joke."
But the queen remained frozen.
"Go to the door. I believe you are right."
"Oh, madam, I couldn't do that. Open it at once, Agnes."
"Oh, madam, but suppose he is there?"
She had caught the feeling. The hopeless rushlights were not enough. He might have been in the room itself, in a dark corner. She rose in a flutter, like a partridge while the hawk is over, and plucked at her skirt. For both women the castle was suddenly too dark, too empty, too lonely, too northerly, too full of night and winter.
"If you open it, he will go away."
"But we must give him time to go away." They strove with their voices, feeling themselves to be under a black wing.
"Stand near it, and speak loudly then, before you open."
"Madam, what shall I say?"
"Say, 'Shall I open the door?' Then I will say, 'Yes, I think it is time to go to bed.'"
"I think it is time to go to bed."
"Go on."
"Very good, madam.
Shall I begin?"
"Begin, yes, quickly."
"I don't know as I can do it."
"Oh, Agnes, please be quick."
"Very well, madam. I think I can do it now."
Facing the door as if it might attack her, Agnes addressed it at the top of her voice. "I am going to open the door."
"It is time to go to bed."
Nothing happened.
"Now open it," said the queen.
She lifted the latch and threw it open, and there was Mordred, smiling in the frame.
"Good evening, Agnes."
"Oh, sir!"
The wretched woman dropped him a fluttering curtsy with one hand clutching at her breast and scuttled past him for the stairs. He stood aside politely. When she was gone, he stepped into the room, sumptuous in his black velvet, with one cold diamond beaming in the rushlight from his scarlet badge. Anybody who had not seen him for a month or two would have known at once that he was mad. But his brains had gone so gradually that those who lived with him had failed to see it. He was followed by his small black pug dog, flirting its bright eyes and curly tail.
"Our Agnes seems to be in a nervous state," he said. "Good evening, Guinevere."
"Good evening, Mordred."
"A fine little embroidery. I thought you would be knitting socks for soldiers."
"Why have you come?"
"Just an evening call. You must forgive the drama."
"Do you always wait outside doors?"
"One has to come through a door somehow, madam. It is more convenient than coming through the window, though I believe some people have been known to do that."
"I see. Will you sit down?"
He took his seat with an elaborate gesture, the pug jumping into his lap. In a way, it was tragic to watch him, for he was doing what his mother did. He was acting, and had ceased to be real. People write tragedies in which fatal blondes betray their paramours to ruin, in which Cressidas, Cleopatras, Delilahs, and sometimes even naughty daughters like Jessica bring their lovers or their parents to distress. But these are not the heart of tragedy. They are the fripperies to the soul of man. What does it matter if Antony did fall upon his sword? It only killed him. It is the mother's, not the lover's, lust that rots the mind. It is that which condemns the tragic character to his walking death. It is Jocasta, not Juliet, who dwells in the inner chamber. It is Gertrude, not the silly Ophelia, who sends Hamlet to his madness. The heart of tragedy does not lie in stealing or taking away. Any feather-pated girl can steal a heart. It lies in giving, in putting on, in adding, in smothering without the pillows. Desdemona, robbed of life or honour, is nothing to a Mordred, robbed of himself. His soul stolen, overlaid, wizened, while the mother character lives in triumph, superfluously, and with stifling love endowed on him, seemingly innocent of ill intention. Mordred was the only son of Orkney who never married. He, while his brothers fled to England, was the one who stayed alone with her for 20 years, her living larder. Now that she was dead, he had become her grave. She existed in him like the vampire. When he moved, when he blew his nose, he did it with her movement. When he acted, he became as unreal as she had been pretending to be a virgin for the unicorn. He dabbled in the same cruel magic. He had even begun to keep lapdogs like her, although he had always hated hers with the same bitter jealousy as that with which he had hated her lovers.
"Do I feel a coldness in the air this evening?"
"It is bound to be cold in February."
"I was referring to the delicacy of our personal relationship."
"The protector, whom my husband appointed, is bound to be welcome to the Queen."
"But not the husband's bastard, I suppose."
She lowered her needle and looked him in the face. "I don't understand your coming like this, and I don't know what you want." She had no wish to be hostile, but he was forcing her. She had never been afraid of anyone.
"I was thinking of a chat about the political situation. Just a little chat."
She knew that they had reached a crisis of some sort, and it made her weak. She was too old now to deal with madmen, although she still had no suspicion of his sanity. Only the cumbrous irony of his tone made her feel unreal herself, made her unable to put her own words simply, but she would not give in. "I shall be glad to hear what you want to say."
That is extremely generous of you. Jenny.
It was monstrous. He was making her into one of his fantasies, not speaking to a real person at all. She said indignantly, "Will you be so kind as to address me by my title, Mordred?"
"But certainly. I must apologize if I have been trespassing on Lancelot's preserves."
The sneer acted like a tonic. It raised her stature to the royal lady which she was, to a straight-backed dowager whose rheumatic fingers flashed with rings, who had ridden the world successfully for 50 years.
"I believe," she said at once, "you would find some difficulty in doing that." "Well, however, I am afraid I asked for it. You were always a bit of a spitfire. Queen Jenny."
"Sir Mordred, if you can't behave like a gentleman, I shall go."
"And where will you go?"
"I should go anywhere. Anywhere where a woman old enough to be your mother would be safe from this extravagance."
"The question is," he observed reflectively, "where you would be safe. The plan seems bound to founder in the last resource, when you consider that everybody has gone away to France, and that I am the ruler of the kingdom. Of course, you could go to France, if you could get there."
She understood, or began to understand.
"I don't know what you mean." "Then you must think it out."
"If you will excuse me," she said, rising, "I will call my woman."
"Call her, by all means, though I should have to send her away."
"Agnes will take her orders from me."
"I doubt it. Let us try."
"Mordred, will you leave me?"
"No, Jenny," he said. "I want to stay. But if you will sit down quietly for a minute and listen, I promise to behave like a perfect gentleman, like one of your preux chevaliers, in fact."
"You leave no option."
"Very little."
"What do you want?" she asked. She sat down, folding her hands in her lap. She was accustomed to a life of danger.
"Come now," he said, in high good humour, quite mad, enjoying his cat and mouse. "We must not rush it in this bold way. We must be at ease before we begin our conversation, otherwise it will seem so strained."
"I am listening."
"No, no. You must call me Mordy, or some such pet name. Then it will seem more natural when I call you Jenny. Everything will go forward so much more pleasantly."
She would not answer.
"Guinevere, have you any idea of your position?"
"My position is that of the Queen of England, as yours is that of the Protector."
"While Arthur and Lancelot are fighting each other in France."
"That is so."
"Suppose I were to tell you," he asked, stroking the pug, "that I had a letter this morning, that Arthur and Lancelot are dead."
"I should not believe you."
"They killed each other in battle."
"It is not true," she told him quietly.
"As a matter of fact, it isn't. How did you guess?"
"If it was not true, it was cruel to say so. Why did you say it?"
"A great many people would have believed it, Jenny. I expect a great many will."
"Why should they?" she asked, before she had caught his drift. Then she stopped, catching her breath. For the first time, she began to feel afraid. But it was for Arthur.
"You can't mean—" "Oh, but I can," he exclaimed gaily, "and I do. What do you think would happen if I were to announce poor Arthur's death?"
"But, Mordred, you couldn't do such a thing. They are alive.
You owe everything. The king made you his deputy. Your fealty. It would not be true. Arthur has always treated you with such scrupulous justice, he said with cold eyes. I have never asked to be treated with justice. It is something which he does to people, to amuse himself. But he is your father. So far as that goes, I did not ask to be born. I suppose he did that to amuse himself also.
I see. She sat twisting her sewing in her hands, trying to think.
Why do you hate my husband? She asked, almost with wonder. I don't hate him. I despise him.
He didn't know, she explained gently, that your mother was his sister when it happened.
And I suppose he didn't know that I was his son when he put us out in the boat.
He was scarcely 19, Mordred. They had frightened him with prophecies, and he did what they made him.
My mother was a good woman until she met King Arthur. She had a happy home with Lot of Orkney, and she bore him 4 brave sons. What happened after?
But she was more than twice his age. I should have thought... He stopped her, holding up his hand.
You are speaking of my mother.
I'm sorry, Mordred, but really...
I loved my mother, Mordred. King Arthur came to a woman who was faithful to her husband. When he left, she was a wanton. She ended her life in a naked bed with Sir Lamorack, justly slain by her own child.
Mordred, it is no good saying anything if you can't see, if you can't believe that Arthur is kind and sorry and in trouble. He is fond of you. He was saying how he loved you only a day or two before this misery began.
He can keep his love.
He has been so fair, she pleaded.
The just and noble king. Yes, it is easy to be fair when it is over. That is the amusing part. Justice! He can keep that too.
She said, trying to speak steadily, If you proclaim yourself king, they will come from France to fight you. Then we shall have a double war instead of a single one, and it will be fought in England. The whole fellowship will be blotted out. He smiled in pure delight. It seems unbelievable, she said, pinching the embroidery. There was nothing she could do. For a moment it crossed her mind that if she humiliated herself to him, knelt down on her stiff old knees to plead for mercy, he might be soothed. But it was evidently hopeless. He was fixed in a course, like a bell in a groove. Even his conversation was, as it were, a spoken part. It would end according to the script. Mordred, she said helplessly, have pity on the country people if you will have none on Arthur or on me. He pushed the pug off his lap and stood up, smiling at her with crazy satisfaction. He stretched himself, looking down on her but not seeing her at all.
I should, of course, have pity on you, he said, if not on Arthur.
What do you mean?
I was thinking of a pattern, Jenny. A simple pattern.
She watched him without speaking.
Yes. My father committed incest with my mother. Don't you think it would be a pattern, Jenny, if I were to answer it by marrying my father's wife?
Chapter 12. It was dark in Gawain's tent, except for a flat pan of charcoal which lit it dimly from below. The tent was poor and shabby compared with the splendid pavilions of the English knights. On the hard bed there were a few plaids in the Orkney tartan, and the only ornaments were a leaden bottle of holy water which he was taking for medicine, marked Optimus Egrorum Medicus Fit Thomas Bonorum, together with a withered bunch of heather tied to the pole.
These were his household gods. Gawain was stretched face downwards on the plaids. The man was crying slowly and hopelessly, while Arthur, sitting beside him, stroked his hand. It was his wound that had weakened him, or else he would not have cried. The old king was trying to soothe him.
"Don't grieve about it, Gawain," he said. "You did the best you could."
"It is the second time he has speared me. The second time in a month."
"Lancelot was always strong. The years don't seem to touch him."
"Why can he kill me, then? I begged him to have done with it. I told him that if he left me to be patched, I should but fight him fresh when I was mended. And God," he added tearfully, "my head sore aches."
Arthur said with a sigh, "It was because you got both blows on the same place. That was bad luck."
"It makes a body feel shamed."
"Don't think about it, then. Lie quiet, or you will get feverish again, and will not be able to fight for a long time. Then what would we do? We should be quite lost without our Gawain to lead the battle for us."
"I am but a man of straw, Arthur," he said. "I am but an ill-passioned bully, and I canna kill him."
"People who say they are no good are always the good ones. Let's change the subject and talk about something pleasant. England, for instance."
"We shall never see England again."
"Nonsense. We shall see England just in the spring. Why, it is almost spring now. The snowdrops will have been out for ages, and I dare say Guinevere will have some crocuses already. She is good at gardening."
"Guinevere was kind to me."
"My Gwen is kind to everybody," said the old man proudly. "I wonder what she is doing now. Going to bed, I suppose. Or perhaps she is sitting up late, having a talk with your brother. It would be nice to think that they were talking about us at this minute. Perhaps saying admiring things about Gawain's prowess. Or Gwen might be saying that she wished her old man would come home."
Gawain moved restlessly on the bed. "I have a mind to gang home," he muttered. "If Lancelot hates Clan Orkney, as Modred says, why does he spare the laird of it? Maybe he did kill Gareth by mischance."
"I am sure it was mischance. If you will help to end the war, we may be able to stop it fairly soon. It is your justice we are said to be fighting for now, you know. I and the others who want to fight would have to bow to that eventually. If you are content to make it up, there is nobody who will be more happy than I will be."
"Aye, but I swore to fight him to the death."
"You have had two good tries."
"And taken a braw thrashing ilka time," he said bitterly. "He could have made the war end twice. Nay, it would look like cowardice to compound."
"The bravest people are the ones who don't mind looking like cowards. Remember how Lancelot hid in Joyous Gard for months while we sang songs outside."
"I canna forget our Gareth's face."
"It was sad for all of us." Gawain was trying to think, an effort not made easy to him by practice. On this dark evening it was twice as difficult because of his head. Since the time when Galahad gave him concussion in the quest for the Grail, he had been liable to headaches, and now, by a curious accident, Lancelot had given him two blows in separate duels on the same place.
"What for should I give in?" he asked. "Because he beats me? It would be fleeing him to give in now. If I could fell him in a third engagement, maybe, and spare the cheer, it would be even."
"The fields," said the king thoughtfully, "will soon be kingcups and daisies in England. It would be nice to win a peace."
"Aye, and the Spring Hawking.
The figure twisted in its dim bed with a movement of remembrance, but froze as the pain shot through its skull.
Almighty, but my head throbs sorely.
Would you like me to get a wet cloth for it, or a drink of milk?
Nay, let it bide. It will not help.
Poor Gawain. I hope nothing is broken in it.
The thing that is broken is my spirit. Let us talk of other matters.
The king said doubtfully, I ought not to talk too much. I think I ought to go away and leave you to sleep.
Ach, stay. Dinna leave me by myself. It irks me when I'm by my lone.
The doctor said,
to hell with that doctor. Bide a wee while. Hold my hand. Tell me of England.
There ought to be a post tomorrow, and then we shall be able to read about England.
We shall have the latest news, and there will be a letter from young Mordred, and perhaps my Gwen will write to me. Mordred's letters are cold cheer some way.
Arthur hastened to defend him. That is only because he has an unhappy life. You may depend upon it, there is a regular fire of love inside him. Gwen used to say that all his warmth was for his mother.
He was fond of our mother.
Perhaps he was in love with her.
That would account for why he was jealous of ye.
Gawain was surprised at this discovery, which had struck him for the first time.
Perhaps that was why he allowed Sir Agravaine to kill her, when she had that affair with Lamorak. Poor boy. He has been ill-treated by the world. He's the only brother I have left.
I know. Lancelot's was a tragic accident. The Laird of Lothian moved his bandage feverishly.
But it canna have been an accident. I could ja lose it had they worn their helms. But they were bonnetless. He must have known them.
We have talked this over often.
Aye, it is vain.
The old man asked with tragic diffidence, You don't think you could bring yourself to forgive him, Gawain, however it happened? I am not seeking to abandon duty, but if justice could be tempered with mercy...
I will temper it when I hold him at my mercy, not before.
Well, it is for you to say. Here comes the doctor to tell me I have stayed too long. Come in, doctor, come in. But it was the Bishop of Rochester who entered in a bustle, carrying packets and an iron lantern.
It is you, Rochester. We thought you were the doctor.
Good evening, sir, and good evening to you, Sir Gawain.
Good evening.
How is the head today?
It grows better, thank you, my lord.
Well, that is excellent news. And I, he added archly, have brought some good news too. The post has come in early.
Letters.
One for you, he handed it to the king. A long one.
Is there aught for me?
Asked Gawain. Nothing, I am afraid, this week. You will have better luck next time. Arthur took the letters to the lantern and broke the seal.
You will excuse me if I read.
Of course. We cannot stand on ceremony with the news from England. Dear me, I never thought that I should become a palmer at my time of life, Sir Gawain, and have to gallivant in foreign parts. The bishop's prattle died away. Arthur had made no movement. He had turned neither red nor pale, nor dropped the letter, nor stared in front of him. He was reading quietly, but Rochester stopped speaking, and Gawain raised himself on one elbow. They watched him reading, open-mouthed.
Sir?
Nothing, he said, brushing them away with his hand. Excuse me, the news.
I hope...
Let me finish, please. Talk to Sir Gawain.
Gawain asked,
Is there ill tidings? May I see?
No, please, a minute.
Mordred!
No, it is nothing. The doctor says... My lord, I would like to speak to you outside. Gawain began to heave himself into a sitting position.
I will be told.
There is nothing to be upset about. Lie down. We will come back.
If ye go without telling me, I shall follow.
It is nothing. You will hurt your head.
What is it?
Nothing. It is only...
Well?
Well, Gawain, he said, suddenly collapsing. It seems that Mordred has proclaimed himself the King of England under this new order of his.
Mordred!
He has told his thrashers that we are dead, you see, Arthur explained, as if it were some sort of problem, and...
Mordred says we are dead?
He says we are dead, and... But he could not frame it.
And what?
He is going to marry Gwen. There was a moment of dead silence, while the bishop's hand strayed vaguely to his pectoral cross, and Gawain's clenched itself in the bedclothes. Then they both spoke at once.
The Lord Protector! It cannot be true! It'll be a jest! My brother would not do a thing like yon!
Unfortunately, it is true, said the king patiently. This is a letter from Guinevere. Heaven knows how she managed to get it through.
The queen's age!
After the proclamation he proposed to her, she had nobody to help. The queen accepted his proposal.
Accepted, Mordred!
Gawain had managed to swing his legs over the side of the bed.
Uncle, give me the letter.
He took it out of the limp hand, which yielded it automatically, and began to read, tilting the page to the light. Arthur continued to explain. The queen accepted Mordred's proposal and asked for permission to go to London for her trousseau. When she was in London with the few who remained faithful, she threw herself suddenly into the tower and barred the gates.
Thank God it is a strong fort. They are besieging her in the Tower of London now, and Mordred is using guns.
Rochester asked in bewilderment,
Guns? He is using the cannon.
It was too much for the old priest's intellect.
It is incredible, he said, to say we are dead, and to marry the queen, and then to use cannon.
Now that the guns have come, said Arthur, the table is over. We must hurry home.
To use cannons against men.
We must go to the rescue immediately, my lord. Gawain can stay here. But the Laird of Orkney was out of bed.
Gawain, what are you doing? Lie down at once. I am coming with ye.
Gawain, lie down. Rochester, help me with him.
My last brother has broken his fealty.
Gawain.
And Lancelot. Oh, God, my head.
He stood swaying in the dim light, holding the bandage with both hands, while his shadow moved grotesquely round the tent pole.
Chapter 13. Anguish of Ireland had once dreamt of a wind which blew down all their castles and towns, and this one was conspiring to do it. It was blowing round Benwick Castle on all the organ stops. The noises it made sounded like inchoate masses of silk being pulled through trees as we pull hair through a comb, like heaps of sand pouring on fine sand from a scoop, like gigantic linens being torn, like drums in distant battle, like an endless snake switching through the world's undergrowth of trees and houses, like old men sighing and women howling and wolves running. It whistled, hummed, throbbed, boomed in the chimneys. Above all, it sounded like a live creature, some monstrous, elemental being wailing its damnation. It was Dante's wind, bearing lost lovers and cranes, Sabbathless Satan, toiling and turmoiling. In the Western Ocean it harried the sea flat, lifting water bodily out of water and carrying it as spume. On dry land it made the trees lean down before it. The gnarled thorn trees, which had grown in double trunks, groaned one trunk against the other with plaintive screams. In the whipping and snapping branches of the trees, the birds rode it out head to wind, their bodies horizontal, their neat claws turned to anchors. The peregrines in the cliffs sat stoically, their mutton-chop whiskers made streaky by the rain and the wet feathers standing upright on their heads. The wild geese, beating out to their night's rest in the twilight, scarcely won a yard a minute against the streaming air, their tumultuary cries blown backward from them, so that they had to be passed before you heard them, although they were only a few feet up. The mallard and widgeon, coming in high with the gale behind, were gone before they had arrived. Under the doors of the castle, the piercing blasts tortured the flapping rushes on the floors. They booed in the tubes of the corkscrew stairs, rattled the wooden shutters, whined shrilly through the shot windows, stirred the cold tapestries in frigid undulations, searched for backbones. The stone towers thrilled under them, trembling bodily like the bass string of musical instruments. The slates flew off and shattered themselves with desultory crashes. Bor and Bleoberis were crouching over a bright fire, to which the bitter wind seemed to have given the property of throwing out light without heat. Even the fire seemed frozen, like a painted one. Their minds were baffled by the plague of air.
"But why did they go so quickly?" asked Bor complainingly. "I never knew a siege to be raised like that before. They raised it overnight. They went as if they had been blown away."
They must have had bad news. Something must have gone wrong in England.
Perhaps. If they had decided to forgive Lancelot, they would have sent a message.
It does seem strange, sailing away at a moment's notice without saying anything.
Do you think there can have been a revolt in Cornwall, or in Wales, or in Ireland?
There are always the old ones, agreed Bleoberis numbly.
I don't think it could be a revolt. I think the king was taken ill and had to be carried home quickly. Or Gawain might have been taken ill. That blow which Lancelot gave him the second time, perhaps it perched his brain pan.
Perhaps.
Bor banged the fire.
To go off like that and never say a word?
Why doesn't Lancelot do something?
What can he do?
I don't know.
The king has banished him.
Yes.
Then there is nothing to do.
All the same, said Bleoberis, I wish he would do something.
A door opened with a clatter at the bottom of the turret stairs. The tapestries swirled out, the rushes stood on end, the fire gushed smoke, and Lancelot's voice, embedded in the wind, shouted,
Bor! Bleoberis! Damaris! Here!
Where?
Up here!
As the distant door closed, silence returned to the room. The rushes lay down again, and Lancelot's feet sounded clearly on the stone steps, where before it had been difficult to hear his shout. He came in hastily, carrying a letter.
Bor, Bleoberis, I've been looking for you.
They had stood up.
A letter has come from England. The messengers were blown ashore, 5 miles up the coast. We shall have to go at once.
To England?
Yes, yes, to England, of course. I have told Lionel to act as transport officer, and I want you, Bor, to look after fodder. We shall have to wait until the gale blows itself out.
Why are we going? Asked Bor.
You should tell us the news.
News? He said vaguely.
There is no time for that. I will tell you in the boat. Here, read the letter.
He handed it to Bor and was gone before they could reply.
Well, read what it says.
I don't even know who it is from.
Perhaps it will say in the letter. Lancelot reappeared before they had taken their researches further than the date.
Bleoberis, he said, I forgot. I want you to look after the horses. Here, give me the writing. If you two start spelling it out, you'll be reading all night.
What does it say?
Most of the news came by the messenger. It seems that Mordred has revolted against Arthur, proclaimed himself the leader of England, and proposed to Guinevere.
But she is married already, protested Bleoberis.
That is why the siege was broken up. Then it appears Mordred raised an army in Kent to oppose the king's landing. He had given it out that Arthur was dead. He is besieging the queen in the Tower of London and using cannon.
Cannon?
He met Arthur at Dover and fought a battle to prevent the landing. It was a bad engagement, half on sea and half on land, but the king won. He won to land.
Who wrote the letter?
Lancelot suddenly sat down.
It is from Gawain. From poor Gawain. He is dead.
Dead?
How can he write? Began Bleoberis. It is a dreadful letter. Gawain was a good man. All you people who forced me to fight him, you didn't see what a heart he had inside.
Read it,
suggested Bor impatiently. It seems that a cut which I gave him on the head was a dangerous one. He never ought to have travelled. But he was lonely and miserable, and he had been betrayed. His last brother had turned traitor. He insisted on going back to help the king. And in the landing battle, he tried to strike his blow. Unfortunately, he was clubbed on the old wound and died of it a few hours later.
I don't see why you should be disturbed.
Listen to the letter. Lancelot carried it to the window and fell silent, examining the writing. There was something touching about it, the hand being so unlike its author. Gawain had hardly been the sort of person you thought of as a writer. Indeed, it would have seemed more natural if he had been illiterate, like most of the others. Yet here, instead of the spiky Gothic then in use, was the lovely old Gaelic minuscule, as neat and round and small as when he had learned it from some ancient saint in dim Dunlothian. He had written so unfrequently since that the art had retained its beauty. It was an old maid's hand, or an old-fashioned boy's, sitting with his feet hooked round the legs of a stool and his tongue out, writing carefully. He had carried this innocent precision, these dainty, demoded cusps, through misery and passion to old age. It was as if a bright boy had stepped out of the black armour, a small boy with a drop on the end of his nose, his feet bare with blue toes, a root of tangle in the thin bundle of carrots which were his fingers.
Unto Sir Lancelot, flower of all noble knights that ever I heard of or saw by my days, I, Sir Gawain, King Lot's son of Orkney, sister son unto the noble King Arthur, send thee greetings. And I will that all the world wit that I, Sir Gawain, knight of the Round Table, sought my death at thy hands, and not through thy deserving, but it was mine own seeking. Wherefore I beseech thee, Sir Lancelot, to return again unto this realm, and see my tomb, and pray some prayer more or less for my soul. And this same day that I wrote this seal, I was hurt to the death in the same wound which I had on thy hand, Sir Lancelot, for of a more nobler man might I not be slain. Also, Sir Lancelot, for all the love that ever was betwixt us.
Lancelot stopped reading and threw the letter on the table.
Here, he said, I can't go on. He urges me to come with speed to help the king against his brother, his last relation. Gawain loved his family, Bor, and in the end he was left with none. yet he wrote to forgive me. He even said that it was his own fault. God knows, he was a right good brother. What are we to do about the king? We must get to England as quickly as we can. Mordred has retreated to Canterbury, where he offers a fresh battle. It may be over by now. This news has been delayed by storm. Everything depends on speed. Bleobaris said, I will go and look to the horses. When do we sail? Tomorrow. Tonight. Now. When the wind drops. Be quick with them. Good. And you, Bor, the fodder. Yes.
Lancelot followed Bleobaris to the stairs, but turned in the doorway.
The queen is besieged, he said. We must get her out.
Yes. Bor, left alone with the wind, picked up the letter with curiosity. He tilted it in the failing light, admiring the Z-like G, the curly B, and the curved T, like the blade of a plough. Each tiny line was the furrow it threw up, sweet as the new earth. But the furrow wandered towards the end. He turned it about, observing the brown signature. He spelled out the conclusion, making speaking movements with his mouth, while the rushes tapped and the smoke puffed and the wind howled.
And at this date my letter was written, but 2 hours and a half afore my death, written with mine own hand, and so subscribed with part of my heart's blood. Gawain of Orkney.
He spelled the name out twice and tapped his teeth.
Gawain. I suppose, he said out loud, doubtfully, they would have pronounced it Cuculain in the north. You can't tell with ancient languages.
Then he put down the letter, went over to the dreary window, and began humming a tune called Broom, Broom on Hill, whose words have been lost to us in the wave of time. Perhaps they were like the modern ones, which say that
still the blood is strong, the heart is Highland, and we in dreams behold the Hebrides.
Chapter 14. The same wind of sorrow whistled round the king's pavilion at Salisbury. Inside there was a silent calm after the riot of the open. It was a sumptuous interior. What with the royal tapestries, Uriah was there, still in the article of bisection, and the couch strewn deep with furs and the flashing candles, it was a marquee rather than a tent. The king's mail gleamed dully on a rack at the back. An ill-bred falcon, who was subject to the vice of screaming, stood hooded and motionless on a perch like a parrot's, brooding in some ancestral nightmare. A greyhound, as white as ivory, couching on its hocks and elbows, its tail curved into the bony sickle of the greyhound, watched the old man with the doe-soft eyes of pity. A superb enameled chessboard, with pieces of jasper and crystal, stood a checkmate beside the bed. There were papers everywhere. They covered the secretary's table, the reading desk, the stools, dreary papers of government, still bravely persevered in, of law, still to be codified, of commissariat, and of armament, and of orders for the day. A large ledger lay open at the note of some wretched defaulter, William Atty Lane, who had been condemned to be hanged, suspendatur, for looting. On the margin, in the secretary's neat hand, was the laconic epitaph, Susp, suitable to the mood of tragedy. Covering the reading desk, there were endless piles of petitions and memorials, all annotated with the royal decision and signature. On those to which the king had agreed, he had written laboriously, Le roi le veut. The rejected petitions were marked with the courtly evasion always used by royalty, Le roi s'advisera. The reading desk and its seat were made in one piece, and there the king himself sat drooping.
His head lay among the papers, scattering them. He looked as if he were dead. He nearly was. Arthur was tired out. He had been broken by the two battles which he had fought already, the one at Dover, the other at Barham Down. His wife was a prisoner, his oldest friend was banished, his son was trying to kill him, Gawain was buried, his table was dispersed, his country was at war. Yet he could have breasted all these things in some way if the central tenet of his heart had not been ravaged. Long ago, when his mind had been a nimble boy's called wart, long ago he had been taught by an aged benevolence wagging a white beard. He had been taught by Merlin to believe that man was perfectible, that he was on the whole more decent than beastly, that good was worth trying, that there was no such thing as original sin. He had been forged as a weapon for the aid of man, on the assumption that men were good. He had been forged by that deluded old teacher into a sort of Pasteur, or Curie, or patient discoverer of insulin. The service for which he had been destined had been against force, the mental illness of humanity. His table, his idea of chivalry, his holy grail, his devotion to justice, there had been progressive steps in the effort for which he had been bred. He was like a scientist who had pursued the root of cancer all his life. Might, to have ended it, to have made men happier. But the whole structure depended on the first premise, that man was decent. Looking back at his life, it seemed to him that he had been struggling all the time to dam a flood, which, whenever he had checked it, had broken through at a new place, setting him his work to do again. It was the flood of force majeure. During the earliest days before his marriage, he had tried to match its strength with strength, in his battles against the Gaelic Confederation, only to find that two wrongs did not make a right. But he had crushed the feudal dream of war successfully. Then, with his round table, he had tried to harness tyranny in lesser forms, so that its power might be used for useful ends. He had sent out the men of might to rescue the oppressed and to straighten evil, to put down the individual might of barons, just as he had put down the might of kings. They had done so, until, in the course of time, the ends had been achieved, but the force had remained upon his hands unchastened. So he had sought for a new channel, had sent them out on God's business, searching for the Holy Grail. That, too, had been a failure, because those who had achieved the quest had become perfect and been lost to the world, while those who had failed in it had soon returned no better. At last he had sought to make a map of force, as it were, to bind it down by laws. He had tried to codify the evil uses of might by individuals, so that he might set bounds to them by the impersonal justice of the state. He had been prepared to sacrifice his wife and his best friend to the impersonality of justice. And then, even as the might of the individual seemed to have been curbed, the principle of might had sprung up behind him in another shape, in the shape of collective might, of banded ferocity, of numerous armies insusceptible to individual laws. He had bound the might of units, only to find that it was assumed by pluralities. He had conquered murder to be faced with war. There were no laws for that. The wars of his early days, those against Lot and the dictator of Rome, had been battles to upset the feudal convention of warfare as fox-hunting or as gambling for ransom. To upset it, he had introduced the idea of total war. In his old age, this same total warfare had come back to roost as total hatred, as the most modern of hostilities. Now, with his forehead resting on the papers and his eyes closed, the king was trying not to realize. For if there was such a thing as original sin, if man was, on the whole, a villain, if the Bible was right in saying that the heart of men was deceitful above all things and desperately wicked, then the purpose of life had been a vain one. Chivalry and justice became a child's illusions if the stock on which he had tried to graft them was to be the thrasher, was to be Homo ferox instead of Homo sapiens. Behind this thought, there was a worse one, with which he dared not grapple. Perhaps man was neither good nor bad, was only a machine in an insensate universe, his courage no more than a reflex to danger, like the automatic jump at the pinprick. Perhaps there were no virtues, unless jumping at pinpricks was a virtue, and humanity only a mechanical donkey led on by the iron carrot of love through the pointless treadmill of reproduction. Perhaps might was a law of nature, needed to keep the survivors fit. Perhaps he himself. But he could challenge it no further. He felt as if there was something atrophied between his eyes, where the base of the nose grew into the skull. He could not sleep. He had bad dreams. Tomorrow was the final battle. Meanwhile, there were all these papers to read and sign, but he could neither read nor sign them. He could not lift his head from the desk. Why did men fight? The old man had always been a dutiful thinker, never an inspired one. Now his exhausted brain slipped into its accustomed circles, the withered paths like those of the donkey in the treadmill, round which he had plodded many thousand times in vain. Was it the wicked leaders who led innocent populations to slaughter? Or was it wicked populations who chose leaders after their own hearts? On the face of it, it seemed unlikely that one leader could force a million Englishmen against their will. If, for instance, Mordred had been anxious to make the English wear petticoats or stand on their heads, they would surely not have joined his party, however clever or persuasive or deceitful or even terrible his inducements. A leader was surely forced to offer something which appealed to those he led. He might give the impetus to the falling building, but surely it had to be toppling on its own account before it fell. If this were true, then wars were not calamities into which amiable innocents were led by evil men. They were notional movements, deeper, more subtle in origin. And indeed, it did not feel to him as if he or Mordred had led their country to its misery. If it was so easy to lead one's country in various directions, as if she was a pig on a string, why had he failed to lead her into chivalry, into justice, and into peace? He had been trying. Then again, this was the second circle. It was like the inferno. If neither he nor Mordred had really set the misery in motion, who had been the cause? How did the fact of war begin in general? For any one war seemed so rooted in its antecedents. Mordred went back to Morgause, Morgause to Uther Pendragon, Uther to his ancestors. It seemed as if Cain had slain Abel, seizing his country, after which the men of Abel had sought to win their patrimony again for ever. Man had gone on through age after age, avenging wrong with wrong, slaughter with slaughter. Nobody was the better for it, since both sides always suffered, yet everybody was inextricable. The present war might be attributed to Mordred or to himself, but also it was due to a million thrashers, to Lancelot, Guinevere, Gawain, everybody. Those who lived by the sword were forced to die by it. It was as if everything would lead to sorrow,
so long as man refused to forget the past. The wrongs of Uther and of Cain were wrongs which could have been righted only by the blessing of forgetting them. Sisters, mothers, grandmothers, everything was rooted in the past. Actions of any sort in one generation might have incalculable consequences in another, so that merely to sneeze was a pebble thrown into a pond whose circles might lap the furthest shores. It seemed as if the only hope was not to act at all, to draw no swords for anything, to hold oneself still, like a pebble not thrown. But that would be hateful. What was right? What was wrong? What distinguished doing from not doing? If I were to have my time again, the old king thought, I would bury myself in a monastery, for fear of a doing which might lead to woe. The blessing of forgetfulness, that was the first essential. If everything one did, or which one's fathers had done, was an endless sequence of doings doomed to break forth bloodily, then the past must be obliterated, and a new start made. Man must be ready to say, yes, since Cain there has been injustice, but we can only set the misery right if we accept a status quo. Lands have been robbed, men slain, nations humiliated. Let us now start fresh without remembrance, rather than live forward and backward at the same time. We cannot build the future by avenging the past. Let us sit down as brothers and accept the peace of God. Unfortunately, men did say this. In each successive war, they were always saying that the present one was to be the last, and afterwards there was to be a heaven. They were always to rebuild such a new world as never was seen. When the time came, however, they were too stupid. They were like children crying out that they would build a house, but when it came to building, they had not the practical ability. They did not know the way to choose the right materials. The old man's thoughts went laboriously. They were leading him nowhere. They doubled back on themselves and ran the same course twice, yet he was so accustomed to them that he could not stop. He entered another circle. Perhaps the great cause of war was possession, as John Ball the communist had said. The matters goeth nat well to pass in Engeland, he had stated, nor shall nat do till every thing be common, and that there be no villeins nor gentlemen. Perhaps wars were fought because people said, my kingdom, my wife, my lover, my possessions. This is what he and Lancelot and all of them had always held behind their thoughts. Perhaps so long as people tried to possess things separately from each other, even honour and souls, there would be wars forever. The hungry wolf would always attack the fat reindeer. The poor man would rob the banker. The serf would make revolutions against the higher class, and the lackpenny nation would fight the rich. Perhaps wars only happen between those who had and those who had not. As against this, you were forced to place the fact that nobody could define the state of having. A knight with a silver suit of armour would immediately call himself a have-not if he met a knight with a golden one. But he thought, assume for a moment that having, however it is defined, might be the crux of the problem. I have, and Mordred has not. He protested to himself in contradiction. It is not fair to put it like that, as if Mordred or I were the movers of the storm. For indeed, we are nothing but figureheads to complex forces which seem to be under a kind of impulse. It is as if there was an impulse in the fabric of society. Mordred is urged along, almost helplessly now, by numbers of people too many to count.
people who believe in John Ball, hoping to gain power over their fellow men by asserting that all are equal, or people who see in any upheaval a chance to advance their own might. It seems to come from underneath. Ball's men and Mordred's are the underdogs seeking to rise, or the knights who were not leaders of the Round Table and therefore hated it, or the poor who would be rich, or the powerless seeking to gain power. And my men, for whom I am no more than a standard or a talisman, are the knights who were leaders, the rich defending their possessions, the powerful unready to let it slip. It is a meeting of the haves and have-nots in force, an insane clash between bodies of men, not between leaders. But let that pass. Assume the vague idea that war is due to having in general. In that case, the proper thing would be to refuse to have at all. Such, as Rochester had sometimes pointed out, was the advice of God. There had been the rich man who was threatened with the needle's eye, and there had been the money changers. That was why the church could not interfere too much in the sad affairs of the world, as Rochester said, because the nations and the classes and the individuals were always crying out, "Mine, mine," where the church was instructed to say, "Ours." If this were true, then it would not be a question only of sharing property as such. It would be a question of sharing everything, even thoughts, feelings, lives. God had told people that they would have to cease to live as individuals. They would have to go into the force of life, like a drop falling into a river. God had said that it was only the men who could give up their jealous selves, their futile individualities of happiness and sorrow, who would die peacefully and enter the ring. He that would have his life was asked to lose it. Yet there was something in the old white head which could not accept the godly view. Obviously you might cure a cancer of the womb by not having a womb in the first place. Sweeping and drastic remedies could cut out anything, and life with the cut. Ideal advice, which nobody was built to follow, was no advice at all. Advising heaven to earth was useless. Another worn-out circle spun before him. Perhaps war was due to fear of reliability. Unless there was truth, and unless people told the truth, there was always danger in everything outside the individual. You told the truth to yourself, but you had no surety for your neighbour. This uncertainty must end by making the neighbour a menace. Such, at any rate, would have been Lancelot's explanation of the war. He had been used to say that man's most vital possession was his word. Poor Lance. He had broken his own word. All the same, there had been few men with such a good one. Perhaps wars happened because nations had no confidence in the word. They were frightened, and so they fought. Nations were like people. They had feelings of inferiority or of superiority, or of revenge, or of fear. It was right to personify nations. Suspicion and fear, possessiveness and greed, resentment for ancestral wrong, all these seemed to be a part of it. Yet they were not the solution. He could not see the real solution. He was too old and tired and miserable to think constructively. He was only a man who had meant well, who had been spurred along that course of thinking by an eccentric necromancer with a weakness for humanity. Justice had been his last attempt, to do nothing which was not just. But it had ended in failure. To do at all had proved too difficult. He was done himself. Arthur proved that he was not quite done by lifting his head.
There was something invincible in his heart, a tincture of grandness in simplicity. He sat upright and reached for the iron bell. "Page," he said, as the small boy trotted in, knuckling his eyes.
"My lord?"
The king looked at him. Even in his own extremity he was able to notice others, especially if they were fresh or decent. When he had comforted the broken Gawain in his tent, he had been the one who was more in need of comfort. "My poor child," he said, "you ought to be in bed." He observed the boy with a strained, threadbare attention. It was long since he had seen youth's innocence and certainty. "Look," he said, "will you take this note to the bishop? Don't wake him if he is asleep."
"My lord."
"Thank you." As the live creature went, he called it back. "Oh, page."
"My lord."
"What is your name?"
"Tom, my lord," it said politely.
"Where do you live?"
"Near Warwick, my lord."
"Near Warwick." The old man seemed to be trying to imagine the place, as if it were paradise terrestre, or a country described by Mandeville.
"At a place called Newbold Revel. It is a pretty one."
"How old are you?"
"I shall be 13 in November, my lord."
"And I have kept you up all night."
"No, my lord. I slept a lot on one of the saddles."
"Tom of Newbold Revel," he said with wonder. "We seem to have involved a lot of people. Tell me, Tom, what do you intend to do tomorrow?"
"I shall fight, sir. I have a good bow."
"And will you kill people with this bow?"
"Yes, my lord. A great many, I hope."
"Suppose they were to kill you?"
"Then I should be dead, my lord."
"I see.
Shall I take the letter now?"
"No, no, wait a minute. I want to talk to somebody. Only my head is muddled."
"Shall I fetch a glass of wine?"
"No, Tom. Sit down and try to listen. Lift those chessmen off the stool. Can you understand things when they are said?"
"Yes, my lord. I am good at understanding."
"Could you understand if I asked you not to fight tomorrow?"
"I should want to fight,"
it said stoutly. "Everybody wants to fight, Tom, but nobody knows why. Suppose I were to ask you not to fight, as a special favour to the king. Would you do that?"
"I should do what I was told."
"Listen, then. Sit for a minute and I will tell you a story. I am a very old man, Tom, and you are young. When you are old, you will be able to tell what I have told tonight, and I want you to do that. Do you understand this want?"
"Yes, sir. I think so."
"Put it like this. There was a king once, called King Arthur. That is me. When he came to the throne of England, he found that all the kings and barons were fighting against each other like madmen, and as they could afford to fight in expensive suits of armour, there was practically nothing which could stop them from doing what they pleased. They did a lot of bad things because they lived by force. Now, this king had an idea, and the idea was that force ought to be used, if it were used at all, on behalf of justice, not on its own account. Follow this, young boy. He thought that if he could get his barons fighting for truth, and to help weak people, and to redress wrongs,
then their fighting might not be such a bad thing as once it used to be. So he gathered together all the true and kindly people that he knew, and he dressed them in armour, and he made them knights, and taught them his idea, and set them down at a round table. There were 150 of them in the happy days, and King Arthur loved his table with all his heart. He was prouder of it than he was of his own dear wife. And for many years his new knights went about killing ogres and rescuing damsels and saving poor prisoners and trying to set the world to rights. That was the king's idea.
I think it was a good idea, my lord.
It was, and it was not. God knows.
What happened to the king in the end? Asked the child, when the story seemed to have dried up.
For some reason, things went wrong. The table split into factions, a bitter war began, and all were killed.
The boy interrupted confidently. No, he said, not all. The king won. We shall win. Arthur smiled vaguely and shook his head. He would have nothing but the truth.
Everybody was killed, he repeated, except a certain page. I know what I am talking about.
My lord?
This page was called Young Tom of Newbold Revel near Warwick, and the old king sent him off before the battle upon pain of dire disgrace. You see, the king wanted there to be somebody left who would remember their famous idea. He wanted badly that Tom should go back to Newbold Revel, where he could grow into a man and live his life in Warwickshire peace. And he wanted him to tell everybody who would listen about this ancient idea, which both of them had once thought good. Do you think you could do that, Thomas, to please the king?
The child said, with the pure eyes of absolute truth, I would do anything for King Arthur.
That's a brave fellow. Now listen, man. Don't get these legendary people muddled up. It is I who tell you about my idea. It is I who am going to command you to take horse to Warwickshire at once, and not to fight with your bow tomorrow at all. Do you understand all this?
Yes, King Arthur.
Will you promise to be careful of yourself afterward? Will you try to remember that you are a kind of vessel to carry on the idea when things go wrong, and that the whole hope depends on you alive?
I will.
It seems selfish of me to use you for it.
It is an honour for your poor page, good my lord.
Thomas, my idea of those knights was a sort of candle, like these ones here. I have carried it for many years with a hand to shield it from the wind. It has flickered often. I am giving you the candle now. You won't let it out.
It will burn.
Good, Tom. The light bringer. How old did you say you were?
Nearly 13.
60 more years then, perhaps. Half a century.
I will give it to other people, King. English people.
You will say to them in Warwickshire, Hey, he wore a wonderly fine candle.
Aye, lad, that I will.
Then 'tis. Now, Tom, for thee must go right quickly. Thou'lt take the best son of a mare that thee canst find, and thou wilt ride post into Warwickshire, lad, where nought but the curlew.
I will ride post, mate, so that the candle burn.
Good, Tom, then.
God bless thee. Don't thee forget thick Bishop of Rochester afore thou goest.
The little boy kneeled down to kiss his master's hand, his surcoat with the Mallory bearings looking absurdly new.
My Lord of England, he said.
Arthur raised him gently to kiss him on the shoulder.
Sir Thomas of Warwick, he said.
And the boy was gone. The tent was empty, tawny, and magnificent. The wind wailed and the candles guttered. Waiting for the bishop, the old, old man sat down at his reading desk. Presently his head drooped forward on the papers. The greyhound's eyes, catching the candles as she watched him, burned spectrally two amber cups of feral light. Mordred's cannonade, which he was to keep up through the darkness until the morning's battle, began to thud and bump outside. The king, drained of his last effort, gave way to sorrow. Even when his visitor's hand lifted the tent flap, the silent drops coursed down his nose and fell on the parchment with regular ticks, like an ancient clock. He turned his head aside, unwilling to be seen, unable to do better. The flap fell as the strange figure in cloak and hat came softly in.
Merlin?
But there was nobody there. He had dreamt him in a catnap of old age.
Merlin.
He began to think again, but now it was as clearly as it had ever been. He remembered the aged necromancer who had educated him, who had educated him with animals. There were, he remembered, something like 500,000 different species of animal, of which mankind was only one. Of course man was an animal. He was not a vegetable or a mineral, was he? And Merlin had taught him about animals so that the single species might learn by looking at the problems of the thousands. He saw the problem before him as plain as a map. The fantastic thing about war was that it was fought about nothing, literally nothing. Frontiers were imaginary lines. There was no visible line between Scotland and England, although Flodden and Bannockburn had been fought about it. It was geography which was the cause, political geography. It was nothing else. Nations did not need to have the same kind of civilization, nor the same kind of leader. They could keep their own civilizations, like Eskimos and Hottentots, if they would give each other freedom of trade and free passage and access to the world. Countries would have to become counties, but counties which could keep their own culture and local laws. The imaginary lines on the earth's surface only needed to be unimagined. The old king felt refreshed, clear-headed, almost ready to begin again. There would be a day, there must be a day, when he would come back to Grammarly with a new round table, which had no corners, just as the world had none. A table without boundaries between the nations who would sit to feast there. The hope of making it would lie in culture. If people could be persuaded to read and write, not just to eat and make love, there was still a chance that they might come to reason. But it was too late for another effort then. For that time, it was his destiny to die, or, as some say, to be carried off to Avilion, where he could wait for better days. For that time, it was Lancelot's fate and Guinevere's to take the tonsure and the veil, while Mordred must be slain. The fate of this man or that man was less than a drop, although it was a sparkling one, in the great blue motion of the sunlit sea. The cannons of his adversary were thundering in the tattered morning, when the Majesty of England drew himself up to meet the future, with a peaceful heart. Explicit liber quartus. Incipit liber quintus. The Book of Merlin. Chapter 1. It was not the Bishop of Rochester. The king turned his head away from the newcomer, incurious as to his identity. The tears running down his loose cheeks with their slow plods made him feel ashamed to be seen, yet he was too vanquished to check them. He turned stubbornly from the light, unable to do more. He had reached the stage at which it was not worthwhile to hide an old man's misery. Merlin sat down beside him and took the worn hand, which made the tears flow faster. The magician patted the hand, holding it quietly with a thumb on its blue veins, waiting for life to revive. "Merlin?" asked the king. He did not seem to be surprised. "Are you a dream?" he asked. "Last night I dreamt that Gawain came to me, with a troop of fair ladies. He said they were allowed to come with him because he had rescued them in his lifetime, and they had come to warn us that we should all be killed tomorrow. Then I had another dream, that I was sitting on a throne strapped to the top of a wheel, and the wheel turned over, and I was thrown into a pit of snakes. The wheel is come full circle. I am here." "Are you a bad dream?" he asked. "If you are, do not torment me." Merlin still held the hand. He stroked along the veins, trying to make them sink into the flesh. He soothed the flaky skin and poured life into it with mysterious concentration, encouraging it to resilience. He tried to make the body flexible under his fingertips, helping the blood to course, putting a bloom and smoothness on the swollen joints, but not speaking. "You are a good dream," said the king. "I hope you will go on dreaming." "I am not a dream at all. I am the man whom you remembered." "Oh, Merlin, it has been so miserable since you left. Everything which you helped to do was wrong. All your teaching was deception. Nothing was worth doing. You and I will be forgotten, like people who never were."
"Forgotten?" asked the magician. He smiled in the candlelight, looking round the tent as if to assure himself of its furs and twinkling mail, and the tapestries and vellums.
"There was a king," he said, "whom Nennius wrote about, and Geoffrey of Monmouth. The Archdeacon of Oxford was said to have had a hand in him, and even that delightful ass, Gerald the Welshman. Brute, Layamon, and the rest of them. What a lot of lies they all managed to tell. Some said that he was a Briton painted blue, some that he was in chain mail to shoot the ideas of the Norman romancers. Certain lumbering Germans dressed him up to vie with their tedious Siegfrieds. Others put him into plate, like your friend Thomas of Hutton Conyers. And others again, notably a romantic Elizabethan called Hughes, recognized his extraordinary problem of love. Then there was a blind poet who tried to justify God's ways to man, and he weighed Arthur against Adam, wondering which was the more important of the two. At the same time came masters of music, like Purcell, and later still such titans as the Romantics, endlessly dreaming about our king. There came men who dressed him in armour like ivy leaves, and who made all his friends to stand about among ruins with brambles twining round them, or else to swoon backward, with a mellow blur kissing them on the lips. Also, there was Victoria's lord. Even the most unlikely people meddled with him, people like Aubrey Beardsley, who illustrated his history. After a bit, there was poor old White, who thought that we represented the ideas of chivalry.
He said that our importance lay in our decency, in our resistance against the bloody mind of man. What an anachronist he was, dear fellow. Fancy starting after William the Conqueror and ending in the Wars of the Roses. Then there were people who turned out the Mort d'Arthur in mystic waves like the wireless, and others in an undiscovered hemisphere who still pretended that Arthur and Merlin were the natural fathers of themselves in pictures which would move. The matter of Britain. Certainly we were forgotten, Arthur. If 1,000 years and 500,000, and yet 1,000 years again, are to be the measure of forgetfulness.
Who is this wight?
A fellow, replied the magician absently. Just listen, will you, while I recite a piece from Kipling.
And the old gentleman proceeded to intone with passion the famous paragraph out of Pook's Hill.
I've seen Sir Huon and a troop of his people setting off from Tintagel Castle for Ibrascul in the teeth of a sou-westerly gale, with the spray flying all over the castle and the horses of the hill wild with fright. Out they'd go in a lull, screaming like gulls, and back they'd be driven 5 good miles inland before they could come head to wind again. It was magic, magic as black as Merlin could make it, and the whole sea was green fire and white foam with singing mermaids in it, and the horses of the hill picked their way from one wave to another by the lightning flashes. That was how it was in the old days. There's a description for you, he added when he had finished the piece. There is prose. No wonder the Dan cried splendid at the end of it. And all was written about ourselves, or about our friends.
But, Master, I do not understand.
The magician stood up, looking at his ancient pupil in perplexity. He twisted his beard into several rat tails, put the corners in his mouth, twirled his mustachios, and cracked his finger joints. He was frightened of what he had done to the king. Feeling as if he were trying to revive a drowned man with artificial respiration, who was nearly too far gone. But he was not ashamed. When you are a scientist, you must press on without remorse, following the only thing of any importance, truth. Later, he asked quietly, as if he were calling somebody who was asleep.
What?
There was no reply.
King?
The bitter answer was,
Le roi s'advisera.
It was worse than he had feared. He sat down, took the limp hand, and began to wheedle.
One more try, he asked. We are not quite done.
What is the use of trying?
It is a thing which people do.
People are dupes, then.
The old fellow replied frankly,
People are dupes, and wicked, too. That is what makes it interesting to get them better.
His victim opened his eyes, but closed them wearily.
The thing which you were thinking about before I came, King, was true. I mean about Homo ferox. But hawks are ferae natura also. That is their interest.
The eyes remained closed.
The thing which you were thinking about people being machines, that was not true. Or if it is true, it does not signify. For if we are all machines ourselves, then there are none to bother about.
I see.
Curiously enough, he did see. Also his eyes came open, and remained open.
Do you remember the angel in the Bible, who was ready to spare whole cities, provided that one just man could be found? Was it one? That applies to Homo ferox, Arthur, even now.
The eyes began to watch their vision closely.
You have been taking my advice too literally, King. To disbelieve in original sin does not mean that you must believe in original virtue. It only means that you must not believe that people are utterly wicked. Wicked they may be, and even very wicked, but not utterly. Otherwise, I agree, it would be no use trying.
Arthur said with one of his sweet smiles,
This is a good dream. I hope it will be long.
His teacher took out his spectacles, polished them, put them on his nose, and examined the old man carefully. There was a hint of satisfaction behind the lenses.
Unless, he said, you had lived this, you would not have known it. One has to live one's knowledge. How are you?
Fairly well. How are you?
Very well.
They shook hands as if they had just met.
Will you be staying?
Actually, replied the necromancer, now blowing his nose furiously in order to hide his glee, or perhaps to hide his contrition, I shall hardly be here at all. I have been sent with an invitation.
He folded his handkerchief and replaced it in his cap.
Any mice?
Asked the king, with a first faint twinkle. The skin of his face twitched, as it were, or tautened itself for a fraction of a second, so that you could see underneath it, in the bone perhaps, the freckled, snub-nosed countenance of a little boy who had once been charmed by Archimedes. Merlin took the skullcap off indulgently.
One, he said. I think it was a mouse, but it has become partly shriveled. And here, I see, is the frog I picked up in the summer. It had been run over, poor creature, during the drought. A perfect silhouette.
He examined it complacently before putting it back, then crossed his legs and examined his companion in the same way, nursing his knee.
The invitation, he said. We were hoping you would pay us a visit. Your battle can look after itself until tomorrow, we suppose.
Nothing matters in a dream.
This seemed to anger him, for he exclaimed with some vexation, I wish you would stop about dreams. How would you like it if I were to call you a dream? You must consider other people.
Never mind.
The invitation, then. It was to visit my cave, where young Nimue put me. Do you remember her? There are some friends in it waiting to meet you.
It would be beautiful.
Your battle is arranged, I believe, and you would hardly sleep in any case. It might cheer your heart to come.
Nothing is arranged, said the king, but dreams arrange themselves.
At this the aged gentleman leapt from his seat, clutching his forehead as if he had been shot in it, and raised his wand of lignum vitae to the skies.
Merciful powers! Dreams again!
He took off his conical hat with a stately gesture, looked piercingly upon the bearded figure opposite, which looked as old as he did, and banged himself on the head with his wand as a mark of exclamation. Then he sat down, half stunned, having misjudged the emphasis. The old king watched him with a warming mind. Now that he was dreaming of his long-lost friend so vividly, he began to see why Merlin had always clowned on purpose. It had been a means of helping people to learn in a happy way. He began to feel the greatest affection, which was even mixed with awe, for his tutor's ancient courage, which could go on believing and trying with undaunted crankiness, spite of ages of experience. He began to be lightened at the thought that benevolence and valour could persist. In the lightening of his heart, he smiled, closed his eyes, and dropped asleep in earnest.
Chapter 2
When he opened them, it was still dark. Merlin was there, moodily scratching the greyhound's ears and muttering. He had saved his pupil from misery before by being nasty to him, when he was a young boy called the Wart, but he knew that the poor old chap before him now had suffered too much misery for the trick to work again. The next best thing was to distract the king's attention, he must have decided, for he set to work as soon as the eyes were open, in a way which all magicians understand. They're accustomed to palm things off on people, under a mirage of patter.
Now, he said, dreams. We must get this over for good and all. Apart from the maddening indignity of being called a dream, personally because it muddles you, it confuses other people. How about the learned readers? And it is degrading to ourselves. When I was a third-rate schoolmaster in the 20th century, or was it the 19th, every single boy I ever met wrote essays for me which ended, "Then he woke up." You say that the dream was the only literary convention of their most degraded classrooms. Are we to be this? We are the matter of Britain, remember. And what of Onero criticism, I ask? What are the psychologists to make of it? Stuff as dreams are made of is stuff and nonsense, in my opinion.
Yes, said the king meekly.
Do I look like a dream?
Yes.
Merlin seemed to gasp with vexation, then put the whole beard into his mouth at one mouthful. After this, he blew his nose and went away to stand in a corner with his face to the canvas, where he began to soliloquize indignantly.
Of all the persecutions and floutings, he stated, how can a necromancer prove he is not a vision when suspected of the baseness? A ghost may prove he is alive by being pinched, but not so with a By Our Lady dream. For Argyll, you can dream of pinches, yet, hist, there is the noted remedy in which the dreamer pinches his own leg. Arthur, he directed, turning round like a top, be pleased to pinch yourself.
Yes.
Now, does this prove you are awake?
I doubt it.
The vision examined him sadly.
I was afraid it would not,
it agreed, and it returned to its corner, where it began to recite some complicated passages from Burton, Jung, Hippocrates, and Sir Thomas Browne. After 5 minutes, it struck its fist into the palm of the other hand and marched back to the candlelight, inspired by the bed of Cleopatra.
Listen, Merlin announced. Have you ever dreamt of a smell?
Dreamt of a smell?
Do not repeat.
I can hardly...
Come, come. You have dreamt of a sight, have you not? And of a feeling? Everybody has dreamt of a feeling. You may even have dreamt of a taste. I recollect that once, when I had forgotten to eat anything for a fortnight, I dreamt of a chocolate pudding, which I distinctly tasted, but it was snatched away. The question is, have you ever dreamt of a smell?
I do not think I have, not to smell it.
Make sure. Do not stare like an idiot, my dear man, but attend to the matter in hand. Have you ever dreamt with your nose?
Never. I cannot remember dreaming of a smell.
You are positive.
Positive?
Then, smell that,
cried the necromancer, snatching off his skullcap and presenting it under Arthur's nose, with its cargo of mice, frogs, and a few shrimps for salmon fishing, which he had overlooked.
Phew! Am I a dream now?
It does not smell like one.
Well, then.
Merlin, said the king, it makes no difference whether you are a dream or not, so long as you are here. Sit down and be patient for a little if you can. Tell me the reason of your visit. Talk. Say you have come to save us from this war.
The old fellow had achieved his object of artificial respiration as well as he could. So now he sat down comfortably and took the matter in hand.
No, he said. Nobody can be saved from anything unless they save themselves. It is hopeless doing things for people. It is often very dangerous indeed to do things at all. And the only thing worth doing for the race is to increase its stock of ideas. Then, if you make available a larger stock, the people are at liberty to help themselves from out of it. By this process, the means of improvement is offered, to be accepted or rejected freely. And there is a faint hope of progress in the course of the millennia. Such is the business of the philosopher, to open new ideas. It is not his business to impose them on people.
You did not tell me this before.
Why not?
You have egged me into doing things during all my life. The chivalry and the round table which you made me invent, what were these but efforts to save people and to get things done?
They were ideas, said the philosopher firmly, rudimentary ideas. All thought in its early stages begins as action. The actions which you have been wading through have been ideas, clumsy ones, of course, but they had to be established as a foundation before we could begin to think in earnest. You have been teaching man to think in action. Now it is time to think in our heads.
So my table was not a failure, Master?
Certainly not. It was an experiment. Experiments lead to new ones, and this is why I have come to take you to our burrow.
I am ready, he said, amazed to find that he was feeling happy.
The committee discovered that there had been some gaps in your education, two of them, and it was determined that these ought to be put right before concluding the active stage of the idea.